Okay. Let me just ask a favor, which is to interrupt me and ask questions as I'm talking.
Okay.
And this reminds me of the guy who goes to the lawyer and asks, how much do you charge? And the lawyer says, well, it's $200 for three questions. And the guy says, that's pretty steep, isn't it? He says, yes, it is. And what is your third question? But anyway, if you ask questions as I talk, it'll be much easier. And everyone gets three questions. Okay. So first, let me just say something about the title. Since we've been talking about this algorithm and this method for almost 7 years now, a more appropriate title would be a not-so-new. Okay. For those of you who have never opened a biology textbook or read a biology journal, you need to know that helical polymers are ubiquitous. And in many cases, most of the protein in a cell can be assembled into various helical polymers. And the reason for this has to do with just underlying simplicity, that this is the simplest arrangement you can have between any two asymmetric molecules. And every protein is completely asymmetric. No protein has internal symmetry. So if you just randomly place, create a bonding rule between two copies of the same molecule, in general, that bonding rule can be repeated infinitely, and it'll give you a helical polymer. There are limiting cases where, in fact, you can have a symmetrical dimer or trimer, tetramer, or some point group symmetry. But these are much more restrictive relationships between proteins. So the simplest aggregation state that's repeatable and regular between proteins is going to produce a helical polymer. They've also played, in addition to being important in biology, they've played an important role in structural biology, our understanding of macromolecular complexes, our understanding of higher order structure. And if you go back to the original paper of DeRozzi and Klug, one of whose authors is sitting here in the front row, this was the first three-dimensional reconstruction in the electron microscope, and that was on a helical polymer. So, in fact, the whole field of three-dimensional EM emerged with this paper, an application to a helical structure. And then if you look at other very important milestones in electron microscopy, such as the acetylcholine receptor or the bacterial flagella filament, where we have near atomic resolution, these are on helical polymers. So these polymers have played important roles. However, the bad news is that most helical polymers have been really quite refractory to high-resolution studies by electron microscopy, and they're incompatible with crystallization for the obvious reason that unless a polymer has exactly 2, 3, 4, or 6 subunits per turn, it can't be crystallized in any space group. So there are some polymers, in fact, that have been crystallized in their native form, but those are exceptions rather than the rule. So when we look at all of the polymers that have not been amenable to high-resolution studies, which is most of them, we can see that there's tremendous disorder of variability. We can see different types of heterogeneity. And we can see weak scattering, which I'll talk about. So we developed a method about 7 years ago, which we published in Ultramicroscopy and applied to the REC-A protein. And this is the human RAD51 polymer that's formed on DNA. It's very important now, we understand, in cancer in terms of interactions with proteins such as BRCA2. We've been applying it to, phage proteins that form helical filaments on DNA, very similar to REC-A and RAD51. We've been applying it extensively to actin, and I'll talk about some examples from actin today. Actin, bacterial pili. We've been applying it to multiple conformational states of REC-A, type 3 secretion system needles that are structural homologs of the bacterial flagella system, REC-A, actin. RAD-A, it's an archaeal recombination protein, again, forms filaments similar to REC-A and RAD51, and pathogenic type 4 pili.
I have a question.
Yes.
Having now tiled the entire screen, does that mean you're finished for your career?
No.
No,
because
you covered the subject.
Right. This is called an orthogonal basis that spans all covers. But no, the point is that other people have actually been able to use the algorithm and get covers as well, but I haven't shown this. So there's some intrinsic tie between the algorithm and getting a cover. But the point here The only point here is that the algorithm has been extensively tested. That's the only point I wanted to make. So let's go back to the 1968, the incredible breakthrough of DeRozier and Klug and the notion of a Fourier-Bessel approach to helical diffraction and to helical reconstruction. So I refer to this as the traditional approach, even though David is a very non-traditional type person. But we can ask, what's the problem with it? Well, most real filaments are never straight over long distances. They're flexible. All these polymers have some degree of flexibility. So you can try and correct this computational schemes. One that I developed involves spline algorithms. But this is intrinsically artifactual. If you have small amounts of curvature, then, of course, the artifacts become smaller and smaller. Indexing, which I will not really go through today, can be very difficult and frequently ambiguous. It turns out that some of the ambiguities are intrinsic geometric properties of helical objects, so that at a limited resolution, you cannot unequivocally determine the symmetry of an object. And you can get multiple solutions using any technique. So if there's one technique that claims that it can distinguish between these, I would argue it must be artifactual, because just at the limited resolution, you do not have that information. The absence of any constraints over the long range means that disorder accumulates, and over very long distances or for very disordered polymers over short distances, you have almost a liquid-like order. So many polymers have such a great variability, and I'll show you examples of these, that these traditional Fourier-Bessel methods are useless. It's like trying to use 2D crystallographic methods on an amorphous aggregate. There's no crystalline symmetry. Similarly, that these helical polymers are so disordered that the imposition of helical symmetry becomes useless. Oh, here's an example of dynein tubes in ice. This was done with Jenny Hinshaw. If you look at these, they look fairly regular and periodic. But if we cut small boxes, like the size shown over here, and then within that box characterize the mean pitch of the helix, this is the histogram that results, which is frightfully bad. You can see that this pitch is going from about 90 angstroms to 135 angstroms. So obviously, if you're imposing a uniform symmetry on this type of tube, you're just going to be blurring out all structural features, because this thing is varying considerably. And as I'll try and show to you, these type helical polymers appear to be the rule rather than the exception. This is not any more disordered or more variable than many of the other things that we've worked on. So there's also no reason for there to be a simple symmetry expressed as a ratio of small integers. If you go back to the traditional derivation, it's all described in terms of these selection rules and small repeats, where a structure repeats in 13 subunits in 6 turns or 49 subunits in 3 turns. But in fact, there's no reason why any real structure should have a symmetry that can be expressed as this ratio of small integers. And then the problem is that the traditional method, I'd say, is ill-conditioned in the sense that very small changes in symmetry can lead to this catastrophic change in what's called the selection rule. Here's an example of actin. The simplest approximation of actin is that it's a helix with 13 subunits and 6 turns. Therefore, it repeats every 355 angstroms. But if you just change the mean twist between actin subunits by an eighth of a degree, then the simplest integer approximation is that it has 1,299 subunits repeating in 600 turns, and the repeat now is 35,000 angstroms instead of 355 angstroms. So if you're trying to use a formalism that's based upon repeats, this becomes catastrophic. And there's a technical problem, which is that Bessel overlap can occur at very low resolution. A classic example of that is the myosin thick filament. In collaboration with Raul Padron and Roger Craig, we showed in a Nature paper about 2 years ago that we can use our method to look at the myosin thick filament with just unprecedented insight that previously it was almost intractable using traditional means. So in a single snapshot, this is the algorithm. It's an iterative algorithm where this thing keeps on cycling. It depends each cycle upon a reference volume. But what we've been able to show is that if you start with a solid cylinder, we have never seen the method fail. So therefore, the starting reference volume requires no prior knowledge of the structure. And we have yet to encounter a case where the method fails using a featureless solid cylinder.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely. No. No, no, I was going to say, so there are 2 points. One is, in part what you're saying is true. So we have we require no prior knowledge of the structure, but we do require a guess about the symmetry. If we take that symmetry and apply it to noise, in fact, we don't get convergence to any reasonable structure. I've done that because someone was so amazed at the results that they asked me to actually do that, to take noise. Oh, it's a different question that we need a symmetry, and we can get that symmetry many different ways. The main technique we use, which I won't really show you, is the power spectrum, which usually unequivocally gives the symmetry. So for people who are not familiar, let me just say that if we take every segment, and typically we work with 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 segments, you compute the Fourier transform of that, and you take the intensities of that and just add them together, when you have filaments that are vanishingly weak in diffraction, where individual filaments don't give any clear transform or any clear ley lines, the average power spectrum can show this beautifully. And that gives us the symmetry. Yes?
Does the cylinder need to be the right width, a certain width, or a certain length?
Well, the length is just given by the length of the segments that we're cutting. But it turns out it's very insensitive to anything. Sorry.
Could you define reasonable? You said it will not converge into a reasonable structure.
Oh, with pure noise?
Yeah.
Oh, you may just see totally disconnected blobs of density at the symmetry you're defining. Or it'll diverge from that. But clearly with pure noise, it does not give any physically connected structure. Okay, so we need a guess about the starting symmetry, and I'll come back to that point, actually bridge it with a couple of examples. But we take all our individual images and correlate them with the different projections of this reference. So initially, we're just going to have identical projections of a solid cylinder. Every projection is the same if we're just looking at different azimuthal orientations. And you get a random reconstruction. Each cycle, though, you generate a volume where helical symmetry is not imposed, but clearly helical symmetry exists. And we then go into that volume, determine those helical parameters, and impose that to generate this helically averaged reference. And this just gets iterated. So technically, this is all done in SPIDER. And we have a graphical user interface, a front end, that generates everything you need for SPIDER. This generates a SPIDER script where we put in all the different parameters, for instance, the number of images, the image size, your scale, radial minimum, radial maximum, which is used in terms of the search and imposition of helical symmetry. We are defining the limits that we're going to impose. Angular increment for reference projection, well, that's a very standard thing. The larger the diameter of your filament, the more reference projections you need. The higher the resolution, the more reference projections you need. In-plane angular deviation is a way of throwing out bad images. We cut our images from long filaments, so we know that every segment is approximately vertical. If we end up with a segment that correlates against our reference with an angle of 45 degrees, an in-plane rotation of 45 degrees or 70 degrees or 90 degrees, we know that that image is garbage because that image pretty much has to be close to zero or 180 degrees to align against the reference. So we can throw out bad images by putting in a constraint here. Any helical object can be described as a combination of a helical symmetry, which is a rotation and a translation, and a point group symmetry. So for instance, we can put in if a point group symmetry exists. This is a rotation about the helical axis. We can specify the number of cycles we want. I mean, that turns out to be You can kill the thing at any point. And then, most importantly, in terms of Bridget's question, we have to put in some guess about the symmetry. And
when you cut your when you cut out the boxes from the filament,
right.
Is there overlap between
yes.
the boxes?
Yes, there's extensive overlap, and the extent of the overlap is given by these helical parameters. For instance, the axial rise per subunit. If you have an axial rise per subunit that's very large, like in the myosin thick filament, it's 143 angstroms, then in fact you'd want to shift your boxes so that the shift is more than 143 angstroms, because if it's less than that, then basically any two adjacent images can be shifted and correlated to the same reference. Let's say you didn't put in any overlap, then you're throwing out a tremendous amount of information, because within any given segment, if you translate it, that corresponds to a totally different rotation, projection of your structure. So we can boost the signal-to-noise ratio by putting in an extensive overlap. We can minimize repetitive calculations by making sure that that shift is larger than the axial rise per subunit. Okay, most important part of the cycle is going from this asymmetric reconstruction shown over here, that's actually negative stained actin at low resolution, where we do the symmetry search. So we're determining the rotation and translation within this volume that takes density into other density, minimizing the RMS deviation. So this is a two-dimensional search, but we do it in one dimension to speed it up. So first we can just search in rotation holding the axial rise fixed. Then we can search in axial rise holding the rotation fixed. And we find a minimum here. And then we can take that minimum and impose it on this volume, and you now have a helically averaged structure, where this symmetry is typically relaxing. It's the problem of converging to a single stable solution. And once we reach that stable solution, we can run this hundreds of cycles, and because of the helical geometry, it never diverges. So that's a very unique aspect of this type of refinement, that it's completely stable, which in general is not true with single particle work. If you try and do refinements of single particles, hundreds of cycles, typically they're going to fall apart or blow up. So what are the advantages over the traditional approach? This may be beating a dead horse, because they're probably not too... I wasn't talking about you, David. It's pushing an open door. Let me use a different metaphor. Pushing an open door. Because very few people maybe are strong proponents of the traditional Fourier-Bessel approach. So it overcomes a problem of straightening, because we're doing this piecewise linear approximation to the continuum. We can work with very weakly scattering specimens. And I'll give you examples of filamentous phage or pili, where we have reasonable resolution of better than 10 angstroms from objects that don't diffract. Keiichi Namba, who has done magnificent applications of the Fourier-Bessel approach to bacterial flagella filament, failed looking at polyrods. These are a different component of the flagella system, and he used our method, and now they have 10 angstroms or better. The examples I'll show are the filamentous phage and bacterial pili. I'll also show you a number of examples how it can work with very disordered and heterogeneous filaments, where other methods intrinsically fail because of the problem of globally averaging structures that are very variable. So we've published many papers showing the applications of REC-A, RAD51, DMC1, actin, and PAR-M, I'll talk about. And what I'm not going to talk about is transparency to what's a fundamental problem using the Fourier-Bessel method, where the formalism is very simple and very beautiful if every layer line contains a single Bessel order, if you look at all the papers describing helical diffraction and helical indexing. But as soon as you allow for multiple Bessel functions on a single layer line, then this problem becomes very difficult. Yes? Well, you're talking about tubes, probably, where, in fact, they have different helical symmetry. So, well, that's basically using conventional single particle methods. I mean, Yoakum talked about examples of separating out heterogeneity, and other people, you know, also have. But that doesn't have to do so much with this method as just standard single particle type methods where you have... Well, once you sort them out, well, I mean, this algorithm doesn't do that. But one has to use other methods then to simply sort out. But if you have two objects that clearly have different helical symmetry, which is the problem when you have helical tubes that have different diameters, strictly speaking, they have different helical symmetry. They may have a relatively conserved surface lattice, but the helical symmetry is different. Well, it doesn't matter. We're cutting out segments, so it really doesn't matter whether this variability arises within a single filament or between filaments. Yes, the problem of classification is the same. Right. So, well, if it's obvious, then we wouldn't need methods of classification. So, yes. No, because that's circular. In fact, well, I have a review article that shows an example of that in Journal of Structural Biology this year, where because of these ambiguities, geometric ambiguities, so I wasn't going to talk about this now, you could generate two different reconstructions with my method that have totally different symmetry. One has about 13 subunits per turn, the other has 15 subunits per turn. They generate identical projections at a limited resolution. So therefore, helical methods should also give you the same ambiguity. If they don't, it's because the person didn't realize there was another solution. It's not that the helical method is not ambiguous, and this method is. It's purely a geometrical problem that since you don't know the relationship between different projections, you're not doing tilts, then two different structures having different symmetries can give rise to the same set of projections. So this doesn't validate the symmetry if it's wrong. Okay, you need external evidence, like mass per unit length measurements, metal shadowing, prior knowledge of the structure. So what I showed in that review article is that the reconstructions look different enough that if you had prior knowledge of what the subunit looked like, you could distinguish. Fred?
Is there a real space correlate to the Bessel overlap?
No. The reason that it's transparent here and almost intractable problem there is that the Bessel formalism is based upon the notion that basically in a single view you have all the projections that you need. That is, in the simplest case, that every ley line has a different Bessel function. That corresponds to a real space correlate that a single image of a filament gives you all the different projections. We don't make that assumption here. David?
I was just going to say that Bessel overlap means that the structure repeats after some length, so you don't have all views. So you don't have enough information to reconstruct it.
So Ed, you're exploiting the fact that it is not an integer.
Well, no, we're exploiting the fact that every filament together is going to give you all the different views. We're not starting with the assumption that a single filament contains all the views.
In Bessel overlap, you can sort it out if you have different views. Those Bessels beat together and you get different interference between the overlap.
But that's only that's only true.
You can do what Nigel does, and he ignores it. He just puts in the layer line twice and pretends one is one order and one is the other.
Yes.
It sort of sorts itself out.
Well,
another thing is that each tube, for example, that you're looking at has a slightly different helical parameters because the repeats are never identical.
Right.
That means the overlap is different for every tube you analyze. So if you've got overlap in one example, you haven't in the next. So you can certainly collect all the information out to
But it sorts itself out when you have odd and even Bessel functions that are beating. Suppose you have two even, what?
No, even sort of.
More slow, more difficult. Okay, yeah, yes. I'm just saying, but in Nigel's approach, basically you're throwing out one, you're not recovering it.
We just got a noisy data here.
That's right, you're throwing it out. You're right. Here, it's not a problem, so we're recovering all information. Okay, so this is an important point that for those of you who are not intimately familiar with differential equations and Bessel functions, you don't need to thoroughly understand them, so it's easier, certainly conceptually, and I would say in practice. Okay, this is supposed to be a balanced presentation, so I could ask, what are the disadvantages? Okay. Okay. Well, I thought long and hard about this and concluded there were none. Now, it turns out that in the limit of structures that are almost crystalline, the longer the segment that you're looking at by any method, whether it's Fourier-Bessel methods or real space methods, the better you're going to do, because the errors in alignment are going to get larger and larger as you're looking at shorter and shorter segments. So therefore, if you can look at long segments, you're going to do better than short segments. So my method would become very cumbersome as you look at longer and longer objects. Now, Nico has a wonderful paper on TMV where he also used a single particle approach and got about 4.5 angstroms resolution, but he's looking at lengths that were about, 700 angstroms or something, which is typically longer than what we're looking at. So anyway, if you have a perfectly crystalline long helical object, then and there's no Bessel overlap, then in fact you may do better using standard Fourier-Bessel approach. But I would argue those are exceptions and not common.
Actually, say you want to go to really high resolution.
Right.
But David's shown that you can correct for the evil sphere very nicely with a helical thing. You just add a line to your program. Can you do it with this?
Sure.
How easily? How?
Well. As David said, trust me. I'm able to move on. Okay. Unfortunately, we've not yet got to the point where we need to correct for the Ewald sphere. So, okay. But I'm going to talk about... Yeah, okay. So let me just talk about some applications, and then hopefully I'll be able to illustrate some of the points I've already brought up. So we looked at these archaeal flagella filaments and showed, we confirmed the previous notion about structural homology with bacterial type 4 pilus. And the really remarkable thing in biology is that when you look at all of these complexes, you see this underlying simplicity, that there's very little novelty in biology. What's a flagellum in the archaea is actually very similar to what's a pilus in bacteria, common evolutionary origins. And here you can see the arrangement. This is a cross-section of this map. It's not great resolution, but it's enough to show that this is very consistent with the packing of single alpha helices. That's a crystal structure for the type 4 bacterial pilus done by John Tainer's lab. And we can develop the first really full picture of a type 4 pilus in this instance over here, where that crystal structure can be fit into this reconstruction. So this reconstruction is done at about 12 angstroms resolution, and in retrospect, we think we're mainly limited by the microscopy. So this was done with, it's less than a huge data set, but there doesn't appear to be that amount of variability or heterogeneity that we see in many other systems. So this is actually a candidate for going back and doing at significantly higher resolution. But at this resolution of about 12 angstroms, there's an unambiguous fit of the crystal subunit into this filament. I should point out that these filaments don't diffract. Single filaments don't diffract. So this is a great example of a structure that can't be solved by conventional means. We have this reality check. We can generate this reconstruction. And you ask, well, how do you know it has any reality? And the reality is we can fit in the subunits perfectly, or within experimental error. That's a nice reality check. And also then that determines the hand of this reconstruction, because we can generate two identical reconstructions that are mirror images of each other, and we can show that only one of those enantiomorphs fits the crystal structure. So that's nice that at least we have the resolution to unambiguously determine the hand.
Is this ice?
Yes, ice, sure. Here's an example of a type 3 secretion system. that's related to the bacterial flagella. Most of you know the bacterial flagella consists of these different rings and filaments, and they all have this hollow lumen, or most of them have components of a hollow lumen. And we now understand that, in fact, the bacterial flagella system appears to be a specialized form of a type 3 secretion system. So here's an example of these long needle structures that are actually hypodermic needles used for secreting effector proteins from the bacteria into a host cell as part of the pathway of infection. Some of these proteins actually bind, that effector proteins bind actin, and we've been working on at least one of them, bacterial CypA. In ice, again, you can see these filaments, and in ice, single filaments show almost no diffraction. You cannot find any single filaments that give rise to the ley lines that people typically search for in desperation in order to solve a structure by helical means. So here's an example, though, of, well, first, let me, since Joachim talked about CTF correction, other people certainly have, we realized the same problem that Joachim described, which is that thin filaments cannot be masked off from their background without totally corrupting the information from the CTF. So therefore, the approach of correcting the CTF in a final volume is not possible at all. So this is, if it's not obvious to you, the CTF is actually oscillating more rapidly than 1 over D, where D is the filament diameter. And this doesn't occur for absurd limits, where you have, you know, a 20 micron defocus and a 2 angstroms resolution. For reasonable defocus values, 2 microns and reasonable resolutions of like 8 angstroms or 10 angstroms, this occurs for the filaments that we're looking at that are 80 or 100 angstroms in diameter. So the approach we use is that each micrograph is multiplied by the CTF function. Again, this has been done by many other people, both flipping the phases and increasing the signal-to-noise ratio. All particles are then merged, and a single reconstruction is generated from a large defocus set that may include 30 different defocus values. We then divide the Fourier transform of the reconstruction by this function, since that reconstruction has been multiplied by the CTF twice, once by the microscope and once by us. So this is a number weighting. So for every, this is just the number of segments at a particular CTF. Then we now can boost the high frequencies to compensate for the clear fall off in high frequencies due to the envelope function of the microscope, as well as misalignment errors, et cetera. And this can be done first using a simple B factor. We can then fit in an atomic model and get a much better estimate of what the cylindrically averaged, spherically averaged fall off should be in the structure factors, and then just impose the model fall off on our reconstruction. So, doing that with SBA, the most striking thing is that we can classify these segments, and you look at the numbers here. So we're starting with about 60,000 segments, and we can classify them by the axial rise per subunit based upon models that we can build. And you can see this incredible variability from 3.6 angstroms to 5.6 angstroms. So this means that subunits have a variability of almost 50% within this polymer in the axial rise. And this is one reason why there's no diffraction from single filaments, because this variability is occurring within single filaments and not between filaments. So it's not that one filament has this axial rise and another filament has that axial rise. Like actin, which I'm going to come to, this variability is all within filaments. So this blurs out all structural information and would blur out computed Fourier transforms from long segments. Again, this is all done in ice, where we have very weak scattering as well. So we have a combination of weak scattering, you know, due to very low contrast, and we have a variability. But nevertheless, we can recover if we reconstruct those two different bins at about 15 angstroms resolution, which is not great, but it's enough to show some interesting things. So here are two different reconstructions, one from a bin where we have about 5.3 angstroms rise per subunit, one 4.2 angstroms rise per subunit. And now if we cut away the front half of these, and Tom Goddard showed me in Chimera a very nice feature that Chimera shades the cutaway surface. All these figures, by the way, have been done in Chimera. You can now see a remarkable difference around the lumen that in one case, the compressed case, alpha helices, which we know by homology with the bacterial flagella system, are forming the density around the lumen. These alpha helical coiled coils are packed to produce right-handed six-starred helices, and in this case, they're producing left-handed five-starred helices. So as this structure is compressing and extending, the alpha helices are just packing together in a very different manner to give rise to these very different patterns in the interior. So what role does this plasticity play? Well, I'm mainly trying to talk about methods today, but I just thought I'd throw in some biology, that these SBA needles are extremely long, so they have an amazingly large axial ratio, and they have to remain relatively intact in the high shear environment that these bacteria are exposed to in the gut. So you can ask yourself the question, you know, which is going to be more resistant to breakage, a rigid structure or a flexible structure? And people tend to use these terms inappropriately, where people assume something that's strong is rigid and something that's weak is flexible. In fact, there's no simple relationship. The flexible structure is, in fact, much stronger with respect to resistance to breakage because it can accommodate the shear and deformation. The rigid structure is going to be extremely fragile. So if you then ask what happens if a homogeneous rubber tube is stretched, this cartoon here shows, this is only like a 10% stretching, that the diameter is going to constrict. So in fact, the lumen is going to constrict. And if the role of these long filaments is transporting effector proteins through a very long lumen, this constriction of the lumen would trap those proteins there. And in fact, what happens instead is that these things can have alpha helices that slide past each other, repacking to allow compression and extension without changing the size of the lumen. So we've speculated that this structural homology may also arise in components of the flagella system, even though alternate models have been put forward explaining the flexibility of the hook. But that remains to be seen. Okay. Many years ago, David and I first described variable twist in F-actin, and this has now come a long way because I think we can do remarkably better than we could 25 years ago. So if you think of ideal helical geometry, you place one subunit down, and then there's an exact rotation and translation along the axis that defines the next subunit. And then that same symmetry operation, a rotation and translation, generates a third subunit, ad infinitum or ad nauseum, depending upon your point of view. But in variable twist actin, what we actually observed by electron microscopy was consistent with the fact that there's a fixed translation of subunits in this helix, but the ability of subunits to rotate appeared to be quite large, and there was a large range of twist angles that were possible within an actin filament. Well, it's nice that other people, such as Juan and colleagues, have now seen this, in fact, at higher resolution. This is a beautiful crystallographic-type reconstruction of a bundle of actin filaments complexed with another protein named screwin, and they show that the twist, tilt, and rotation of actin screwin subunits deviate widely from an ideal or standard F-actin filament, very consistent with what we've been seeing. So we've also shown that the tilt of actin subunits in these filaments can vary considerably, and this tilted actin involves about a 30-degree rotation or tilt of these subunits. Obviously, there must be a rearrangement of contacts that seems remarkable that actin subunits could have this multiplicity of surfaces that allow the polymer to form. There must be also a conformational change in the actin subunit. So this has been extremely controversial because there are 25 actin crystal structures approximately, and 24 of them show a closed nucleotide binding cleft, whereas here at low resolution, we postulate that the nucleotide binding cleft must open. when a crystallographer at a meeting said that all actin crystal structures show a closed nucleotide binding cleft, and I objected, and I said, there's one crystal structure that shows an open one. He said, that's an artifact of crystallography. I did not make that up. So if we now look at, I'll come back to that in a minute, but we can look at complexes of actin now at much higher resolution than we were able to previously, and look now at details of the nucleotide binding cleft. This is actin complexed with a fragment of an actin binding protein called fimbrin or plastin, depending upon who you are. This is two copies of a calponin homology domain. So these are structural homologs. This domain can superimpose fairly well on that domain. Clearly, they're binding differently to actin, the CH4 domain and CH3 domain. And this is approximately 12 angstroms resolution in ice, which we think is a remarkable advance. It's significantly higher than any ActOS1 reconstruction in terms of people looking at free filaments. And we actually have been able to show that when this protein binds to actin, this nucleotide binding cleft is actually more closed than in any of the 24 crystal structures. So that's consistent with the flexibility of domain-domain orientation, that this cleft can close more. It also shows that there's no conserved mode of interaction, calponin homology domains with actin. There's been a controversy in this field. Normally I try and eschew controversy, but sometimes can't escape it. So we can show now that clearly these CH domains bind differently than other CH domains, which has a general important point in terms of structural genomics and genome annotations, which is merely predicting that there's a conserved structure does not show that the conserved modes of interaction between that structure and other structure. So all these CH domains we know have highly conserved structure, but the way in which they interact with actin can be extremely different. Okay. Well, we've now actually been extending this to look at pure actin in the absence of other proteins, and now have a resolution of about 9 angstroms in ice. We've put in an atomic model here of actin, and we're at the very exciting point where we have enough resolution where we can begin to look at the conformational changes between crystal structures of actin and real actin in a filament. And actin has 4 subdomains. Those have been independently built. Well, these 2 subdomains appear to be fairly rigid and have been built in as a rigid body. This subdomain, subdomain 1, has been built in separately from this subdomain. There's been remarkable evidence about conformational plasticity and lability in this subdomain, both by crystallography and EM. So we've shown at low resolution this subdomain can be so variable in actin that it won't even be seen in 3-dimensional reconstructions. You can reconstruct a filament where this density is completely missing due to very large conformational changes. Under the conditions we're looking at here, we think there's something even more exciting, which is here are 2 crystal structures of subdomain 2 obtained from different crystals by different groups. And if you look at this region over here, in this crystal, Capsch et al., this is a beta strand that's forming a beta sheet with another protein, DNase 1. If you look at this crystal in green, it's an alpha helix. And if you look at 10 other crystals, this region is missing in the electron density due to very large disorder. So it's very ironic that at least one crystallographer has called this structure an artifact of crystallography due to packing in the crystal. But what we think, if we look in our crystal, is that the density here, in fact, appears to be an alpha helix. So under these particular conditions that we're looking at, and I won't go into the whole explanation, but it's very interesting that this really does appear to be part of a molecular switch. And under these conditions, this density in the filament can be an alpha helix. So we're very excited about this work and clearly trying to extend it. So actin is part of a giant superfamily of proteins. That was first clear when a crystal structure of actin was solved. It was recognized that it's a structural homolog of hexokinase. At the same time, the ATPase domain of HSP70 was solved, and that was a third homolog. They all have the same fold. And based upon these 3 crystal structures, hexokinase actin, HSP70, Bork et al. Postulated that what would be conserved in this giant superfamily, if it existed, would be a hinge region based upon the notion that hexokinase does undergo these domain-domain rotations, which have been controversial in actin. And that algorithm really does work. So they've made predictions about a number of bacterial proteins, and subsequent crystal structures have shown that those bacterial proteins, such as PAR-M, do have this conserved fold. PAR-M also gives us the clearest example of this conformational rearrangement between the two major domains where nucleotide is bound in the center here. So this is an animation of two crystal structures. The movie you're seeing is a flight of fantasy because we don't know what the transition states are like. ATP is bound in the cleft. In this closed state, ADP was bound. In the open state, no nucleotide was present during crystallization. That unfortunately leads to conclusions that are probably spurious, that when the subunit is open, it can't bind ATP. And in hexokinase, we know the opposite is true, that a fully open conformation can bind ATP on this major domain. So we've looked at bacterial PAR-M filaments. Again, here, negative stain, all the work has been done in ICE. And we have been able to look at what I call the PAR-M paradox. And that's based upon a notion that in the crystal structures of PAR-M, all of the elements that are different from a crystal structure of monomeric actin are precisely the locations where actin is making subunit-subunit interfaces in the F-actin filament. And that's only a paradox if you think that the filaments formed by PAR-M are almost indistinguishable from F-actin. Because if they're packing together the same way, you'd expect the most conserved region would be the interface in the subunits involved in packing. So the first thing is we've been able to show that Fourier methods that led to the notion that the filaments are conserved with actin can't work due to the incredible variability in PAR-M. So these are segments, short segments of PAR-M filaments in ICE that have been classified based upon their twist. And we can then make a movie animating that variation that's occurring within single filaments. And what you're looking at here is not a gel shift, if anyone's a molecular biologist. These are layer lines that are moving up and down exactly as you'd predict for a structure where the axial rise per subunit is fairly conserved, but the twist is variable. So it's the exact opposite of SBay that I showed you earlier. SBay has a fixed twist and a variable axial rise. So this also addresses the question Bridget raised earlier, which is, how do you make this guess about the symmetry? And from power spectra such as this, you can unambiguously define the symmetry of these filaments. So that's why we do get information about the symmetry from the diffraction. We don't need information about what the structure looks like. We can start these PAR-M reconstructions with a solid cylinder, and this is what they converge to. If we start those reconstructions with a box or cube, they also converge to this. So we can show that no matter what you start with, as long as you have the approximate symmetry, it converges to this structure. It's independent of the starting point. Yeah.
I guess if I don't understand, so what you're showing is that there's heterogeneity.
Right.
And you said you don't sort out heterogeneity.
Oh, no, we do.
So
well,
do you just throw them away?
So what we're doing to generate this reconstruction, so let's say these are actually like six bins. I'm generating a reconstruction here from a single twist state.
Okay, so you throw all the others away.
Well, we don't throw them away. We can generate six different reconstructions. In fact, we've generated 100 different reconstructions. I assure you. What? Excuse me?
Did you try to classify the image before you apply this method?
Well, no, it's being done interactively. So we can start by just not classifying anything, and we generate a single reconstruction that's a relatively low resolution. Okay. Then we can look at characterize the nature of the variability. And what this shows us is that almost all the variability is twist. So we can take our reconstruction and we can generate multiple different twist states of that and use those as models for sorting the segments. If we then take the power spectrum of each of those different classes, what this shows us is that the sorting worked because this is independent. It's not circular. We're generating power spectra from these classes, and the power spectra show us that it's behaving exactly as the sorting predicts. I mean, imagine what bad sorting would look like. Every power spectrum would be the same. So we could generate a beautiful Gaussian histogram of twist, but if we then look at the power spectrum from each, they'd all be the same. And we've seen that happen. That means the sorting doesn't work. Yes?
Did you classify on real unit or power spectrum?
We've done both. In this particular, well, actually, in this case, we've done both. In Dynein, we found that we could actually do better classifying on the power spectrum. Here, the classification that works best was in real space by generating models with different twist. Okay. So here, we can get back to the enantiomorphic ambiguity. If we have a crystal structure and we fit it in, we find out it doesn't fit at all. And then we realize that, in fact, we have to flip the hand of this reconstruction so that the long pitch helices are left-handed rather than right-handed as in F-actin. The one-star helix in actin that's left-handed is now right-handed in this structure. And that was very surprising to us, but that's the only way you can build up a filament model given a crystal structure of this subunit. So that's a testable prediction. We can then use fast freeze deep etch to determine the hand. And in fact, you can see that these long pitch helices over here are left-handed. That's a 3D reconstruction, sort of an incredibly poor resolution from this metal-shadowed sample. And here's corresponding control of actin. The long pitch helices are right-handed. So we confirm the hand assignment. Okay. Well, in order to fit in that atomic, that crystal, in fact, we have to open up the subunit a little bit more than exists in the crystal. These are the two different crystals in cyan and magenta. This was with ADP, that's with no nucleotide, and in our filament, the subunit is opened up by a corresponding amount, the difference between those two. That doesn't prove it's correct, but if we now look at structures of hexokinase that have just been solved in the past year, this state of hexokinase is actually referred to as the closed state because, in fact, now there's a more open state of hexokinase. So it's all relative what's open and closed. But anyway, we can then get insight into what's going on within this filament using the many different reconstructions. So we're not just throwing out all the information. So that's an example of the type of classification. There are, I don't know, probably about 15 bins here. And this is, you know, the trade-off. As you bin this more and more finely, of course, you're going to have fewer segments in each bin, and the reconstructions are going to be noisier. So it's a no-win situation. If you bin it more coarsely, you'll have many more filaments, but you'll have much greater degree of variability. So you just have to try and optimize those too. But now we can compare different reconstructions. And here, arbitrarily, that's the range of classification that we've made. And here are two bins that are relatively close together. And what this comparison shows is that as this twist is changing, so if you look at this subunit, it's rotating between these two different reconstructions, but this domain is relatively fixed. And what's going on is that this other domain is twisting more than the subunits are twisting. So we think that a lot of this variability in twist in filaments formed by both PARM and actin has to do with the internal conformational change that these domains can rotate with respect to each other much more than the subunit-subunit interface is changing. Okay, here's an example now of another weakly scattering specimen where we also can see conformational variability. These are filamentous bacteriophage. These have been very important historically, both in structural biology and in biotechnology. This is FD, which in fact only differs by a single amino acid from M13, the very popular cloning vector. So these are also very interesting because the subunit is only 50 residues, which exists as an integral membrane protein early in the life cycle of the virus. So in the bacterial membrane, it's an integral protein, it's alpha helical, it gets extruded, and in these polymers, there's no membrane present. So this is totally different packing of the same subunit. And this is about 8 angstroms resolution. We were very pleased with that until we realized that 8 angstroms is insufficient to build up a unique atomic model given everything that's known for this subunit. So I showed you an example of bacterial pili at 12 angstroms. It's absolutely sufficient to unambiguously build in a crystal structure. Here, because you have this single alpha helix, in fact, you can't uniquely determine the structure. The problem is compounded by the fact that, in fact, we can separate these out into two different structural states coexisting within the same polymer. And then it's further compounded by the fact that there are two opposing atomic models for the phage determined by X-ray fiber diffraction and NMR, and this agrees with neither of them. So the problem with NMR, I think, is now recognized. There's a recent paper by Susan Strauss and Don Marvin showing that if they take the NMR constraints done by Stan Apella's group, they can impose them on they can fit the X-ray fiber diffraction model. What we think, so the NMR constraints don't give a unique model. What we think is that the X-ray fiber diffraction also doesn't generate a unique model. So we have these high resolution or potentially high resolution constraints from NMR, X-ray fiber diffraction, but they don't generate unique models. And there's also not one unique structure. There's significant structural variability. So as I point out here, this degree of polymorphism shouldn't be entirely surprising given the incredible alanine mutagenesis paper. Everyone's familiar with scanning alanine mutagenesis, where you replace a single residue at a time to an alanine. Here, they did something a bit more aggressive. They replaced 41 residues at the same time to alanine, and they found out that this protein co-assembled almost as efficiently as the wild type, with only 9 wild-type residues. So this is a structural nightmare. So lastly, the point I'm trying to emphasize is that this type of conformational variability and polymorphism appears the rule rather than the exception, or at least maybe we've had the bad luck to only look at things that are highly variable and highly polymorphic. But you could ask, is that just unique to filaments? And I think as we accumulate more and more crystal structures, that really appears not to be the case. This is a paper that came out last year. It's very nice. They're looking at a potassium transporter. And here they had 3 crystal structures. And this is, again, a flight of fantasy. It's an animation among those 3. What's clearer is if you look in a cartoon-type representation, the ribbon representation, you can see that there are interfaces that are absolutely fixed between subunits over here among those 3 crystal structures. And then there are interfaces that must be completely remade in these different structural states. And what we're seeing in the polymers is very consistent in some systems with this type of polymorphism. So the argument I would make is that asking the question of what is the structure of F-actin is almost as bad as asking what is the color of middle C. Philosophers call that a category mistake. What we have to say is, what are the structures of this complex? Because without understanding the range of these different structures, we really won't understand the function. So lastly, and most importantly, the people who've done the work, Vitaly Galkin, Zhang Yu, and Alla Orlover are senior research associates who've been in my lab for many years, who've contributed to all aspects of this. Ying Wang and Kuba Belnicki are graduate students, and within the recent past, there are other graduate students and postdocs who've contributed to this. We've also had wonderful collaborators on a number of these projects. The ESPE work has been done, collaboration with a crystallographer, Natalie Stranacka, University of British Columbia. The ABD2 fragment of fimbrin came from Marie-Christine Labarde at the CNRS in Montpellier, France. PAR-M work was done in collaboration with Dyke Mullins, and John Heuser did the fast-freeze deep etch. Phage-FD has been done in collaboration with a spectroscopist, George Thomas at University of Missouri, Kansas City. Archaeoflagellum was done with Shlomo Trachtenberg at Hebrew University. And the Neisseria gonorrhea pilis was done with John Tainer's group here, Lisa Craig, who's now at Simon Fraser, Mark and Niels Volkman made contributions as well. So thank you. I'll show you the hoop. I mean, what you're asking is, after you determine this in any given volume, and this is really very noise-free because this is a negative stain at low resolution. So in ice at higher resolution, we're going to have a much more noisy volume, but the symmetry is also clearly evident. Basically, once we determine these parameters, we just symmetrize the volume in real space by averaging the asymmetric unit and then generating a new ideal helix that's as long as we want.
So you apply it to the volume?
Yes. So we symmetrize this volume in real space.
And the top part will cut back upon the bottom, right?
No. There's no periodic boundary condition that's needed. Well, that's basically what Nico did, which is related in the sense that he's generating a reconstruction by generating symmetry-related copies of every image. What we're doing is different in the sense that this is being refined. Nico was applying that to a system that has absolutely fixed helical geometry. In general, we don't know the absolute helical symmetry of these objects. So, in fact, I should have shown typical plots. I didn't. Let me just pull one up of what these convergence statistics look like. Maybe someone else wants to. Well, it'll take a second. Well, so here's the rotation angle evolving, and here's the axial rise evolving over cycles, and here's the pitch. So you have three parameters. Only two of them are independent. So we're just searching, let's say, on these two. You can see the pitch converges relatively quickly because that's a low-resolution feature. But once you get to this convergence over here, then this can be run for hundreds of additional cycles, and it'll never diverge from that. There's a radius of convergence that's going to be a function of so many things that it's very difficult to define. Obviously, it's the signal-to-noise ratio. It's the number of particles. It's particular symmetry, et cetera. So we know that you can start it too far away, and you'll never get proper convergence. I'll show you an example of that. Oh, sure. No, this is not. In general, we can unambiguously index it. I mean, we're not doing this ab initio, saying we'll use our method to determine the helical structure. We know you can't do that in general. In some cases, you can. So I showed examples in published papers where, let's say we don't know what the symmetry is, but we assume there's two subunits per turn. And I show that you then, within a few cycles, build up a volume that clearly has an asymmetric unit with three copies in it. So you know that it's six subunits per turn. But this, I'm not claiming that we can, without any prior knowledge, that you can determine the helical symmetry. What I also have shown in published papers is you can get it wrong. Here's an example where intentionally we can get it wrong. These are recombinase UVSX that's like REC-A. It's from a bacteriophage. And I can, it forms two different filaments as a function of nucleotide, and I can now mix the images. So I know that this is a heterogeneous population, and it converges to a stable solution with 90 angstroms pitch. So I'm mixing images that are about 66 angstroms pitch and 94 angstroms pitch. But this is a clue that it's artifactual, because this is the distribution of reference projections. So if you think of any, imagine ribosomes, and they're really randomly oriented in ice, then in fact every projection angle should be equally likely. Okay? For a helix, the same thing is true, that if you think of a helix lying in the plane of your image, every different orientation should be equally likely. And what you see, this is the distribution of azimuthal orientations. This is very far from random. And that's telling us that it's an artifactual solution. Yes, Nico.
I just wanted to say about the symmetry that I think it really depends a little how you apply the symmetry. We had this formula for the CDF correction at some point.
Yeah.
Do you apply it after doing the CDF correction?
Sorry. The formula was the CTF correction. We apply it after doing the reconstructions.
So so at what point do you apply the symmetry then? The helical symmetry, is this after the CTF correction?
No, the symmetry is applied. First, there are different CTF corrections. Images are multiplied by the CTF originally, so phases are all proper.
Yeah, but then you divide by the...
Well, then we're dividing a final volume by a summed CTF term. No, helical symmetry, this is on a final reconstruction. The symmetry is imposed every cycle because the symmetry is searched every cycle. So here's an example of a totally artifactual solution where we started the symmetry search too far away from the true symmetry. So this converges to a solution with about 8 units per turn instead of 6 units per turn. But if we look at this distribution of reference projections, it shows us that the solution's totally artifactual. This distribution should be flat. So.
But I wanted to make another point that was
okay.
For this. And this is that I think the including several, each projection several times instead of applying the symmetry after the reconstruction, in some cases at least better results.
Well, you're basing that on TMV, which, as far as I can...
Also the virus, the rotavirus structure.
Okay, I'm sorry, I missed your talk. Yeah. I got here late last night.
Okay. I agree with you. I haven't done a systematic study.
But just to question, you're talking about an icosahedral example.
In this case, I was here, but to me it was the same. I don't know why.
So we have time for one more question. I want to make sure we get a break. Nigel?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Ed, say you had a sort of hollow of filaments going over a hole. Do you do some sort of pre-selection process before you...
Okay, well, the question Nigel's getting at is most likely out of plane tilt.
No, I was wondering...
Right.
Do you see all these particles going across the hole? Do you just sort of choose them all and process them?
Well, we've done these things both on holes and on carbon.
Well,
so
it doesn't matter where they are. Do you just take everything you see, or do you say look at the diffraction pattern?
No. Most of the things I showed you have no diffraction pattern. The filamentous phage, the S-bay, have no diffraction pattern. So, you know, this is like the vampire that has no image in a mirror. These are structures that have no...
For instance, half of them might be bad filaments because they're sort of partly poking out of the eyes. So are you mixing the good and...
No, we don't have any way of sorting at this level. I mean, the proof is in the pudding in terms of the final result. So since we have crystal structures of actin that fit extremely well at 9 angstroms, or we have crystal structures in other cases that fit at 8 or 10 angstroms, it gives us some confidence in the result.
There'd be nothing to prevent you from sorting if they did show the crack.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. If we had better data and better filaments, sure, you could only do better. No.
You do throw stuff out, right?
Oh, some stuff gets thrown out. I gave you the example of the tilt. If something generates an in-plane tilt that's clearly unphysical, we throw it out.